break through to Alexandria, where German flags were being prepared to welcome the liberators. On the Russian front, the Wehrmacht stood before the gates of Stalingrad. This was the Allies' darkest hour. The prime target of the Germans was the Suez Canal, Egypt, and Palestine, the solar plexus of the British Empire. A breakthrough at Stalingrad could form another arm of a pincer movement to sweep through the Caucasus Mountains and open the doors of India and the Orient. At last, the British came to Yishuv Central and asked the Jews to form guerrilla units to cover the retreat of the British and harass the German occupation. This guerrilla force was called the Palmach. It was later to become the striking arm of the Haganah. Ari Ben Kanan sat down for supper one evening. "I enlisted in the British Army today," he announced quietly. The next day, Ari reported to Kibbutz Beit Alonim, House of the Oaks, where youths from all over Palestine had assembled to organize the Palmach. Chapter 18. Kibbutz Beit Alonim stood at the foot of Mount Tabor, in the center of the Yisrael Valley. Ari was given a commission in the British Army and placed in charge of operations of the guerrilla units of boys and girls, most of whom were in their teens. Most of the officers were old-timers in their mid-twenties, like Ari. Many of the former raider unit men joined the Palmach to indoctrinate the youngsters in the methods of Major P.P. Malcolm. The troops wore no uniforms, nor was their rank below the officers, and boys and girls were treated exactly the same. They were trained with the same sense of biblical destiny that Malcolm had given his fighters. Two of the soldiers showed such promise and leadership that they were advanced to lead units directly under Ari. One was a heavyset kibbutznik from Galilee. His name was Zev Gilboa. He wore a big black mustache, which later became the badge of a male palmachnik. The other was a small, intense young student from Jerusalem, named David Ben-Ami. Neither David nor Zev was yet 20. One day they were paid a visit by General Havenhurst. He was a tall, thin, blonde man in his early 50s. As he inspected the camp, he was aware of the coldness which greeted his presence. After the inspection, Havenhurst asked Ari to report to the camp's headquarters. As Ari entered the office, the two men nodded stiffly, neither concealing his dislike for the other.
"Sit down, Lieutenant Ben Kanan," Havenhurst said. "You are to be commended on your work here with these Palmach troops."
"Thank you, sir."
"Matter of fact, I've been studying your record, or your case history, if you will. You've been a busy chap."
"The conditions of my environment and the unfortunate circumstances of my birth have dictated it," Ari said. "I am a farmer at heart." Havenhurst took the rebuff without showing it.
"My main purpose for coming to Beit Alonim today was to ask you to volunteer for a special assignment. I know that when you enlisted, it was on the proviso that you could train Palmach troops, but we feel this is urgent enough to alter that."
"I'm a soldier in the British Army, General Havenhurst. I will accept any assignment given me."
"Good. Briefly, here is what it consists of. There has been a large German build-up in Syria. We feel they may attempt an invasion of Palestine this spring."
Ari nodded.
"We are not at war with the Vichy French, and we cannot invade Syria. But we do have sufficient Free French forces to do the job, provided we get flawless intelligence. We have selected you for this job because you know Syria and Lebanon from your Hamish Ma days, and also because of your mastery of Arabic. We want you to reassemble those lads who were at Hamish Ma with you and return there to use it as a reconnoitering base. When the invasion begins, there will also be special assignments. There will be a captain's rank in this for you."
"I see one problem, sir."
"Yes?" A great number of my comrades from Hamish Ma have been thrown into jail by the British. Havenhurst's face turned crimson. We will arrange releases.
Yes, sir. One more thing, sir. I have two men here who are exceptional soldiers. I would like to take them to Hamish Ma with me and have them transferred into the British Army.
Very well, Havenhurst said. Take them with you.
Ari walked to the door.
An invasion of Syria at this time is excellent strategy, sir. It will give the British Eighth Army plenty of room to retreat to India.
Havenhurst glared at the Jew.
I suppose it is unnecessary to say, Ben Canaan, that you and I will be on opposite sides of the fence one day?
We already are, sir.
Ari left Beit Alonim with Zev Gilboa and David Ben-Ami as his sergeants and returned to Hamish Mar on the hill which held such bitter memories for him. 50 of the original Haganah gang were assembled, some from many parts of the world where they had been serving in the British forces. Using Hamish Mar as headquarters, Ari's patrols worked all the way up to Damascus. Extreme caution was needed, for the invasion was to be a complete surprise. Ari's basic method was simple. Most of his people spoke fluent Arabic and were familiar with the territory. He sent them out during the day, dressed as Arabs, and they merely walked along the roads gathering information. Although his intelligence was proving flawless, Ari wanted to get right inside Damascus and Beirut. This was a touchy job, and Ari reckoned it called for an individual foray. The one selected had to be able to move perfectly without raising suspicion. Ari checked with Haganah, and they sent him a 17-year-old boy named Yoav Yarkoni. Yarkoni was a Moroccan Jew, born in Casablanca, and could indeed pass for an Arab anywhere. He was small, with saucer-like flashing black eyes and an overabundant sense of humor. In Casablanca, he and his family had lived in Amela, the Oriental African version of a ghetto. These Oriental and African Jews had little in common culturally with their Russian or German counterparts. Most of them were descendants of ancestors who had fled the Spanish Inquisition. Many still had Spanish names. In some Arab lands, the Jews were treated with a measure of fairness and near equality. Of course, no Jew could be entirely equal to a Muslim. 1,000 years before, when Islam swept the world, Jews had been among the most honored of the Arab citizens. They were the court doctors, the philosophers, and the artisans, the top of the Arab society. In the demise of the Arab world that followed the Mongol Wars, the demise of the Jews was worse. There were Jews in Baghdad and Cairo and Damascus and Fez and Kurdistan and Casablanca, throughout the coast of Africa and deep into countries of the Middle East. The Muslims never went to the extremes of the Christians in the matter of killing Jews. Arab riots were always kept within reasonable bounds, a few dozen murders at a time. Yoav Yarkoni and his family had escaped the Mela of Casablanca when he was but a youngster. His family settled down in a kibbutz in Samaria that hugged the sea. It was at Caesarea and called Sdot Yam, Fields of the Sea. Many illegal boats beached near Caesarea, and it was here that Yoav first went to work for Ali Abed as a gunrunner when he was only 12 years of age. When he was 15, he took it upon himself to try a daring feat that spread his fame throughout the Yishuv. Yoav walked from Sdot Yam with a donkey to Baghdad. There he stole some of the precious Iraqi date palm saplings and smuggled them into Palestine. The saplings were sent to Shoshana Kibbutz on the Sea of Galilee and were instrumental in opening an entire new export crop for the Yishuv. Ari's job was easy for young Yoav. He walked to Damascus, to Beirut, to Tyre, and returned to Hamish Mar within 3 weeks. His information confirmed everything they already knew and further located Vichy's strength nearly to a man. Free French forces moved quietly into Palestine, to the Galilee, and deployed for the invasion.
Ari's 50 men were bolstered by a special hand-picked group of 40 Australians, experts in mines, automatic weapons, and explosives. This 90-man force was split into three units of 30 each. Each unit was given a special assignment to cross into Lebanon and Syria ahead of the invasion, advance and hold key roads and bridges against a counterattack until the main body could reach them. Ari's force had the most dangerous of the missions. He was to lead his 30 men right up along the Lebanese coast, penetrate close to a Vichy garrison, and keep them from getting to half a dozen vital mountain bridges, which could halt the Free French advance. Ari took Yoav, Zev, and David with him. He had 16 more Jews and 10 Australians. His unit moved out 24 hours before the invasion and sped up the coast with beautiful ease, for they knew every inch of the way. They passed the six crucial bridges one by one. They stopped 3 miles from the Vichy garrison of Fort Henry and in a mountain pass, mined the roads, set in their machine guns, and waited for the invasion to reach them. As so often happens in a large-scale battle, an error was made. How? Why? Who made it is not so important after it occurs. The eastern arm of the invasion crossed from Transjordan into Syria 12 hours ahead of H hour. As they moved toward Damascus, they tipped off the entire operation. For Ari, it meant he would have to hold his mountain pass for 12 hours, plus the additional 3 or 4 hours it would take for the main body to reach him. Within a few hours after the error was made, the Vichyites had massed 2 battalions with tanks and artillery at Fort Henry and started down the coastal road to blow up the mountain bridges. As soon as Ari saw them coming, he realized something had gone wrong. Quickly, he dispatched David and Zev back to Palestine to bring help. The Vichy troops marched blindly into the pass and were pulverized by explosions and crossfire from both sides of the hill. They fell back, reassembled, and sent artillery fire into the pass. 6 unbelievable hours passed before David and Zev came back with a battalion of Free French troops. All the bridges were intact. There was no breakthrough. The pass was littered with over 400 dead Vichyites who had tried to break Ari's position. 5 men of Ari's force were alive when help arrived. Ari Ben Canaan himself was at death's door. His back was filled with shrapnel. 2 bullets were lodged in his body, and his leg and nose were broken. The Free French went on to complete the invasion of Syria. For Ari Ben Canaan, the war was over. He was taken back to Palestine for a long, slow recovery. The British promoted him to major, and he was decorated for his stand at the mountain pass. Ari had played his role for Allied victory. So had the Yishuv. Members of the Yishuv were in suicide squads that helped capture Tobruk and Bardia. Later, a battalion of Palestinians was at the epic defense of Tobruk. They fought in Italy and in Greece and in Crete and in the lowlands. They numbered thousands in the Royal Air Force. They ran the death patrol along the Mediterranean coast. The Home Guard kept the Arabs under control within Palestine. They fought in the desert in the captures of Sidi Barani, Solom, and Fort Capuzzo. Jewish suicide units were picked for their valor in the campaigns in Eritrea and Ethiopia. 3,000 of the Yishuv joined the free forces of Czechoslovakia, Holland, France, and even Poland. A suicide force of Jews went out to destroy the oil refinery at Tripoli. Every member perished. Jews were used by the British for special spying missions. German Jews were dressed in German uniforms and worked right in Rommel's headquarters. Jews guarded the Mosul oil fields against continued Arab attempts to disrupt production. When the British needed spies in the Balkans, they turned to the Jews and trained them as parachutists. They reasoned that any Jew would be protected by the rest of the Jews in the country where he was dropped. Several were parachuted. Few returned. One girl, Hannah Senesh, from Yoav Yarkoni's kibbutz, was dropped into Hungary and captured. She became a martyr by refusing to her death to break under the cruelest Nazi torture. The Yishuv covered itself with glory. Just as in World War I the British glorified the Arab revolt, so they tried to hide the efforts of the Yishuv in World War II. No country gave with so much vitality to the war. But the British government did not want the Jews to use this as a bargaining point for their homeland aspirations later on. Whitehall and Chatham House kept the Yishuv's war effort one of the best secrets of the war. Rommel never reached Alexandria. They never broke the defenses of Stalingrad. As the tide turned in favor of the British, the Arabs no longer looked for the Germans to liberate them. Quickly they declared war on Germany. The main purpose behind the Arab declarations of war was to gain a vote at the peace conferences and block the Zionists, who had no vote, but only the blood of their sons to show for their efforts. Despite the Yishuv's magnificent record, the British did not revoke the White Paper. Despite the Arab treachery and the fact that they did not raise a finger for victory, they did not revoke it. Even with the ghastly news of the murder of 6 million Jews, the British would not allow the survivors in. The Haganah grew restless. Its ranks were filled with experienced soldiers. But it was the Maccabees who called off the truce. A series of terror bombings shook Palestine from end to end and again sent the British into their Taggart forts. The Maccabees, now numbering in the thousands, blew up one British installation after another. General Havenhurst went after the Maccabees. With surprising swiftness, he snared and deported several hundred Maccabee leaders to the Sudan. But Akiva's avenging warriors were not deterred. Havenhurst ordered newly captured Maccabees to be lashed. The Maccabees retorted by catching British soldiers and whipping them in public. Maccabees were hanged. British soldiers were caught and hanged. A dozen Maccabee bullets and grenades found their mark on a dozen of the more outspoken anti-Jewish officers. Violent and sordid murders were perpetrated by the Arabs in answer to the Maccabees. The Holy Land reeled under the terror. Haj Amin El Husseini was placed on the list of war criminals by the Yugoslav government. He had made himself spiritual head of the Yugoslav Muslims who had fought for the German army. He was placed under arrest in France. The British, however, wanted El Husseini alive and ready to stir up trouble when they needed him. So they helped him escape to Egypt, where he was welcomed as a Muslim hero. In Palestine, his nephew, Jamal, seized control of the Arab community. A new phase of history was bringing the United States into focus as the new power in the Middle East. In addition, since most of the European Jewish communities had been wiped out, by mere process of elimination, Jews and others in the United States became the world leaders of the Zionist movement. With America's rise, the British proposed a joint Anglo-American inquiry into the Palestine situation. This joint committee made another exhaustive survey of the Arabs and the Yishuv. They went to Europe, to the DP camps. They came to the only human conclusion possible. 100,000 Jews must be allowed into Palestine at once. The British balked. It would only be considered if the Haganah and Palmach were disbanded at once. Preposterous. The British found a dozen more reasons not to follow the Commission's recommendations. The Arabs were as relentless as the Maccabees. Throughout the Arab world, there were riots and protests against the Anglo-American Commission. At last, the Yishuv Central had had enough. They sent the Palmach and Haganah on a series of damaging raids on British positions. The British poured in tens of thousands of front-line troops and turned the country into a police state. In a massive roundup, they arrested several hundred prominent leaders of the Yishuv and threw them into Latrun prison. In a masterful countermove, the Haganah blew up every frontier bridge in and out of Palestine in a single night. The Aliyah Bet was putting more and more pressure on the British blockade. Finally, the British Foreign Minister burst forth with an anti-Jewish tirade and proclaimed all further immigration stopped. The answer to this came from the Maccabees. The British had their main headquarters in the right wing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. This hotel was in the new city, with its rear and gardens facing the wall of the old city. A dozen Maccabees, dressed as Arabs, delivered several dozen enormous milk cans to the basement of the hotel. The milk cans were placed under the right wing of the hotel beneath British headquarters. The cans were filled with dynamite. They set the timing devices, cleared the area, and phoned the British a warning to get out of the building. The British scoffed at the idea. This time the Maccabees were playing a prank. They merely wanted to make fools of the British. Surely they would not dare attack British headquarters. In a few minutes, there was a blast heard across the breadth of Palestine. The right wing of the King David Hotel was blown to smithereens. Chapter 19. The Exodus was declared fit and ready for the run to Palestine. Ari set the sailing time as the morning after the Hanukkah party, which the management of the Dome Hotel had arranged on the hotel terrace. 300 places were set. The small Jewish community of Cyprus and the crew of the Exodus sat at a long head table. There was tremendous gaiety as the children rushed to the terrace dressed in new clothing and were deluged with gifts from the people of Cyprus and soldiers from the garrison. The children took one gift each for themselves and marked the rest for the detention camps at Karolos. The tables were bulging with food, and the children squealed with delight. The terrible ordeal of the hunger strike was behind them. They had carried their burden like adults, and now they could act like happy children with complete abandon. All around the terrace, dozens of curious Greeks and British soldiers watched the celebration. Karen looked around frantically for Kitty and lit up when she saw her some distance away, standing with Mark Parker by the rail.
"Come on, Kitty," Karen called. "There's a place for you here." "It's your party," Kitty answered. "I'll just watch."
When everyone had opened his present, David Ben-Ami stood at the head table. The terrace became very still as he began to speak. Only the steady shush of the sea could be heard behind him.
"Tonight we celebrate the first day of Hanukkah," David said. "We celebrate this day in honor of Judah Maccabee and his brave brothers and his band of faithful men who came from the hills of Judea to do combat with the Greeks who enslaved our people."
Some of the youngsters applauded.
"Judah Maccabee had a small band of men, and they had no real right fighting so large and powerful an enemy as the Greeks, who ruled the entire world. But Judah Maccabee had faith. He believed that the one true God would show him the way. Judah was a wonderful fighter. Time and again he tricked the Greeks. His men were the greatest of warriors, for the faith of God was in their hearts. The Maccabees stormed Jerusalem and captured it and drove out the Greeks of Asia Minor who ruled that area of the world." A riot of applause. "Judah entered the temple and his warriors tore down the idol of Zeus and again dedicated the temple to the one true God. The same God who helped us all in our battle with the British."
As David continued with the story of the rebirth of the Jewish nation, Kitty Fremont listened. She looked at Karen and Dov Landau, and she looked at Mark, and she lowered her eyes. Then she felt someone standing alongside her. It was Brigadier Bruce Sutherland.
"Tonight we will light the first candle of the menorah. Each night we will light another candle until there are 8. We call Hanukkah the Feast of Lights."
David Ben-Ami lit the first candle, and the children said "Ooh" and "Ah."
"Tomorrow night we shall light the second Hanukkah candle at sea, and the night after we shall light the third one in Eretz Yisrael."
David placed a small skullcap on his head and opened the Bible.
he will not suffer thy foot to be moved. He that keepeth thee will not slumber.
Kitty's eyes came to rest on the head table. She looked at them. Zev Gilboa, the farmer from the Galilee, and Yoav Yarkoni, the Moroccan Jew, and David Ben-Ami, the scholar from Jerusalem. Her eyes stopped at Ari Ben-Kanan. His eyes were rimmed with weariness now that he had had a chance to relax from his ordeal. David set the Bible down and continued to speak from memory.
Behold, David said, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep.
An icy chill passed through Kitty Fremont's body. Her eyes were fixed on the tired face of Ari Ben-Kanan. Behold, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. The ancient motors of the Exodus groaned as she slid back into the center of Kyrenia Harbor, and she turned and pointed out to sea in the direction of Palestine. At dawn of the second day, everyone sighted land at once.
Palestine! Eretz Yisrael!
A hysteria of laughing and crying and singing and joy burst from the children. The little salvage tug came within sight of land, and the electrifying news spread through the Yishuv. The children, who had brought the mighty British Empire to its knees, were arriving. The Exodus sputtered into Haifa Harbor amid a blast of welcoming horns and whistles. The salute spread from Haifa to the villages and the kibbutzim and the moshavim, and all the way to Jerusalem, to the Yishuv central building, and back again to Haifa. 25,000 Jews poured onto the Haifa dock to cheer the creaky little boat. The Palestine Philharmonic Orchestra played the Jewish anthem, Hatikva, the hope. Tears streaked down the cheeks of Karen Hansen Clement as she looked up into Kitty's face. The Exodus had come home. Book 3. An Eye for an Eye. Thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning. The Word of God as given to Moses in Exodus. Chapter 1. A line of silver and blue buses from the Palestine Bus Cooperative, the Egged Company, awaited the children on the docks. The official celebration was kept to a quick minimum. The children were loaded aboard the buses and whisked out of the harbor area, convoyed by British armored vehicles. The band played and the crowd cheered as they rolled out of sight. Karen tugged her window open and shouted to Kitty, but Kitty could not hear her over the din. The buses disappeared, and the crowd dispersed. In 15 minutes the dock was deserted except for a gang of longshoremen and a few British soldiers on guard duty. Kitty stood motionless by the rail of the Exodus, stunned by the sudden strangeness. It was hard to realize where she was. She looked at Haifa. It was beautiful, with that special beauty that belonged to cities built on hills and around a bay. Close to the waterfront was the Arab sector with crowded clusters of buildings. The Jewish sector sprawled all over the long finger-like slope of Mount Carmel. Kitty looked to her left, just past Haifa, and saw the futuristic shape of the tank and chimney buildings of the immense Haifa oil refinery, the terminus of the lines from the Mosul fields. At a nearby dock, she saw a dozen dilapidated, rickety ships of the Aliyah Bet, which, like the Exodus, had managed to reach Palestine. Zev, David, and Yoav interrupted Kitty's thoughts as they said goodbyes and offered thanks and hoped that they would see her again. And then they, too, were gone, and Kitty was alone. Pretty town, isn't it? Kitty turned around. Ari Ben Canaan was standing behind her. We always bring our guests into Palestine through Haifa. It gives them a good first impression.
Where are the children going?
She asked. They will be dispersed to a half dozen youth Aliyah centers. Some of the centers are located on a kibbutz. Other centers have their own villages. In a few days, I will be able to tell you where Karen is.
I'll be grateful.
What are your plans, Kitty? She laughed sardonically.
I was just asking myself the same thing, along with a dozen other questions. I'm a stranger in town, Mr. Ben Canaan, and I feel a little foolish at the moment, asking myself how I got here. Oh, good Nurse Fremont has a solid profession in which there is always a shortage. I'll find a place somewhere.
Why don't you let me help you get situated?
I suppose you're rather busy. I'm always able to get along.
Listen to me now. I think Youth Aliyah would be perfect for you. The head of the organization is a close friend of mine. I'll arrange an appointment for you in Jerusalem.
That's very kind, but I don't want to impose.
Nonsense. It's the very least. If you can tolerate my company for a few days, I will be happy to drive you to Jerusalem. I must go to Tel Aviv on business first, but it's just as well. It will give me a chance to set your appointment.
I don't want you to feel that you're obligated to do this.
I'm doing it because I want to, Ari said. Kitty wanted to give a sigh of relief. She was nervous about being alone in a strange land. She smiled and thanked him. Good, Ari said. We will have to stay in Haifa tonight because of the road curfew. Pack one bag with what you will need to keep you for a few days. If you carry too much with you, the British will be going through your suitcases every 5 minutes. I'll have the rest of your things sealed and held at customs. After clearances, Ari ordered a taxi and drove up Mount Carmel into the Jewish section, which spread through the hills on the mountainside. Near the top, they stopped at a small pension set in a pine grove. It's better to stay up here. I know too many people, and they won't let me alone for a minute if we stay in the center of town. Now, you rest up. I'll go down the hill and scare up an auto. I'll be back by dinner. That evening, Ari took Kitty to a restaurant on the very top of the Carmel, commanding a view of the entire area. The sight beneath was breathtaking. The whole hillside was alive with green trees and half-hidden brownstone houses and apartment buildings, all done in a square Arabic style. The weird-looking oil refinery appeared to be but a dot from this height, and as it turned dark, a golden string of lights ran down the twisting road from Har HaCarmel into the Arab section by the waterfront. Kitty was flushed with excitement and pleased with Ari's sudden show of attention. She was surprised by the modernness of Jewish Haifa. Why, it was far more modern than Athens or Salonika. Much of the strangeness went away when she was addressed in English by the waiter and a half-dozen people who knew Ari and stopped at their table to exchange greetings. They sipped brandy at the end of the meal, and Kitty became solemn, intent on the panorama below. Are you still wondering what you're doing here?
Very much. It doesn't seem quite real.
You will find that we are quite civilized, and I can even be charming, sometimes. You know, I never have properly thanked you.
You don't have to. You are thanking me very nicely. I can only remember one other place so lovely as this.
That must be San Francisco.
Have you been there, Ari?
No. All Americans say that Haifa reminds them of San Francisco. It was fully dark, and lights twinkled on all over the Carmel hillside. A small orchestra played some light dinner music, and Ari poured Kitty another brandy, and they touched glasses. Suddenly, the music stopped. All conversation halted. With startling speed, a truckload of British troops pulled to a stop before the restaurant, and the place was cordoned off. Six soldiers, led by a captain, entered and looked around. They began to move among the tables, stopping at several and demanding to see identification papers.
"This is just routine," Ari whispered. "You'll get used to it."
The captain in charge of the detail stared at Ari's table, then walked over to it.
"If it isn't Ari Ben Canaan," the captain said sarcastically, "we haven't had your picture on the boards for a long time. I hear you've been making mischief elsewhere."
"Evening, Sergeant," Ari said. "I'd introduce you if I could remember your name."
The captain grinned through clenched teeth.
"Well, I remember yours. We're watching you, Ben Canaan. Your old cell at Acha Jail is lonesome for you. Who knows, maybe the High Commissioner will be smart this time and give you a rope instead."
The captain gave a mock salute and walked on.
"Well," Kitty said, "what a lovely welcome to Palestine. He was certainly a nasty person."
Ari leaned close to Kitty and spoke into her ear.
"He is Captain Alan Bridges. He is one of the best friends the Haganah has. He keeps us advised on every Arab and British move in the Haifa area." That was all for appearance.
Kitty shook her head, bewildered. The patrol left with two Jews whose papers didn't appear in order. The orchestra harassed them with a chorus of, "God Save the King." The lorry drove away, and in a moment it was as though nothing had happened. But Kitty was a little dazed by the suddenness of it, and astonished by the calm of the people.
"You learn to live with tension after a while," Ari said, watching her. "You'll get used to it. It is a country filled with angry, emotional people. After a while, you won't know what to do when you get one of those rare weeks of peace and quiet." "Don't be sorry you came just when you're getting..."
Ari's speech was cut off by a shockwave that ran through the restaurant, rattling the windows and jarring some dishes from the tables. In a second, they saw a huge orange ball of flame push angrily into the sky. Another series of explosions followed, shaking the place to its foundations. Shouts arose.
"The oil refinery! They've got the refinery! Maccabee raid!"
Ari grabbed Kitty's hand.
"Let's get out of here. In 10 minutes, the whole Carmel Valley will be crawling with British soldiers."
The cafe was emptied in seconds. Ari led Kitty out quickly. Below them, oil was flaming madly. The entire city screamed with the frantic siren shrieks of speeding fire trucks and British patrols. Kitty lay awake half the night, trying to comprehend the sudden, violent thing she had seen. She was glad that Ari had been with her. Would she get used to living with this? She was too bewildered to think about it. But at the moment she felt her coming to Palestine was a sorry mistake. The next morning the oil refinery was still blazing. A pall of thick smoke hung over the entire Haifa area. The information spread that the raid was Maccabee terrorist work. It had been led by Ben Moshe, son of Moses, the Maccabee field commander under Akiva, and formerly a professor at the Hebrew University before he rose in Maccabee ranks. The raid was part of a double-pronged Maccabee action. The other strike was against the Lydda airdrome in another part of Palestine, where the terrorists destroyed $6 million worth of Spitfire fighter planes on the ground. The action was the Maccabees' own way of welcoming the exodus. Ari had been able to acquire a small Italian Fiat, a 1933 model. The drive to Tel Aviv took only a few hours under normal conditions. Inasmuch as he had never known conditions to be normal, he suggested they depart Haifa early. They drove down from the Carmel and took the coastal road along the edge of Samaria. Kitty was impressed by the greenness of the fields of the kibbutzim near the sea. Their color showed more brilliantly by contrast to the drabness of the hills and the dulling glare of the sun. A few minutes' drive from Haifa, they met the first roadblock. Ari had warned Kitty to expect it. She watched his reactions. He was apparently not at all annoyed, despite the fact that many of the soldiers knew him and taunted him with the reminder that his amnesty was only temporary. Ari left the main road and drove to the Caesarea ruins on the sea.
A lunch had been packed for them at the pension, and they ate it on the ancient seawall. Ari pointed to the Sdot Yam, fields of the sea, kibbutz, where Yoav Yarkoni lived, and where he had spent much time with the Aliyah Bet when they beached the illegal runners during the 1936 to 1939 riots. Ari showed Kitty how the Arabs had built their town on ruins, some Roman, some Crusader. The Arabs were experts in building on other people's civilizations and had, in fact, constructed only one wholly new city in all of Palestine in 1,000 years. Some of the magnificent Roman statuary and columns had been dragged off from Caesarea and could be found in Arab homes throughout the Sumerian and Sharon districts. After lunch, they continued south toward Tel Aviv. The traffic was light. There was only an occasional busload of either Arabs or Jews or the ever-present donkey cart. Every now and then, a speeding, siren-screaming British convoy raced past them. As they passed Arab sections, Kitty noticed the contrast of these villages and lands. The Arab woman toiled in the fields, and the Arab fields were stony and drab. The women walked along the roadside encased in cumbersome robes with enormous loads balanced on their heads. The coffee houses along the road were filled with listless men sitting motionless or lying down playing backgammon. Below Zichron Yaakov, memory of Jacob, they passed the first barbed-wire-enclosed, ominous-looking Taggart fort. At Hadera, a bit farther, they came to another, and thereafter they seemed to pop up at every town and crossroad. Beyond Hadera, the land around the plain of Sharon was even more lush and fertile. They drove between enormous archways of Australian eucalyptus trees. "Everything you see was waste just 25 years ago," Ari said. In the afternoon, they entered Tel Aviv, the Hill of Spring. Along the Mediterranean coast arose this city so white it dazzled the eye in the afternoon sun. Tel Aviv was like frosting on a cake. Ari drove on broad, tree-lined boulevards between rows of ultra-modern apartment houses. The city was alive with bustle and movement. Kitty liked Tel Aviv the instant she saw it. On Hayarkon Street, right on the sea, Ari checked into Gat Rimon Hotel. In late afternoon, all the shops reopened after the siesta period. Ari and Kitty strolled down Allenby Road. Kitty had to change some currency, purchase a few things, and satisfy a lot of curiosity. Beyond the Mograbi Theater and Plaza, the road was filled with small shops, the honking and rushing of buses, cars, and people. Kitty had to see every last shop. There were a dozen or more bookstores, and she paused to gaze at the cryptic Hebrew letters. They walked and walked, up to Rothschild Boulevard, past the main business district. Here was the older town where Tel Aviv had begun as an outgrowth of Jaffa. The closer they came to the Arab city, the more run down the buildings and shops became. Walking along the streets, connecting the two cities, Kitty felt as though she were walking back in time. The surroundings grew dirtier and more odorous, and the shops grew smaller and shabbier with each step. They circled back to Tel Aviv through a marketplace common to both Jews and Arabs. The narrow street was a mass of haggling people crowded around the stalls. They returned down the opposite side of Allenby Road, back to the Mograbi Plaza, and turned into another wide, tree-lined street. This was Ben Yehuda Street, and it was filled with sidewalk cafes. Each cafe had its own distinctive flavor and its own distinctive clientele. There was a cafe for the gathering of lawyers, and there was a cafe of the socialist politicians, and a cafe of artists, and a businessman's cafe. There was a cafe where fellow travelers of the terrorists hung out, and there was a cafe of old retired folk playing never-ending chess games. All the cafes of Ben Yehuda Street were filled and were bursting with chatter and arguments. The news hawkers of the tiny four-page newspapers shouted out in Hebrew of the Maccabee raids on Lydda and the Haifa refinery, and of the arrival of the Exodus. There was a steady stream of people flowing by. There were Orientals in Mideastern habit, and there were well-groomed women in the latest of fashions from a dozen European countries. Mostly, there were native men in khaki pants and white shirts opened at the necks. They wore thin chain necklaces with a Star of David or some Hebrew pendant. Most of them sported the black mustache, which was a trademark of the native-born. They were a rugged lot. Many were in the blue of a kibbutz with sandaled feet. The native women were tall, angular, and high-breasted in plain dresses or slacks or shorts. There was an aggressiveness and pride about them, even in their walk. Then Ben Yehuda Street became quiet. It was the same sudden quiet that Kitty remembered from the night before at the restaurant in Haifa. A British armored sound truck inched down the middle of Ben Yehuda Street. Tight-lipped Tommies manned machine guns on the car.
"Attention all Jews! The commanding general has ordered a curfew. All Jews must be off the street by dark. Attention all Jews! The commanding general has ordered a curfew. All Jews must be off the street by dark."
A ripple of applause and laughter broke out from the onlookers.
"Watch it, Tommy," someone called. "The next intersection is mined."
When the trucks had passed, the scene quickly returned to normal.
"Let's get back to the hotel," Kitty said.
"I told you, you'll get so that you won't be able to live without excitement inside a month."
"I'll never get used to it, Ari."
They returned to the hotel with their arms filled with Kitty's purchases. After cocktails in the small, quiet bar, there was dinner on the terrace overlooking the sea. Kitty could see the sweep of the coastline, where the new city of Tel Aviv ran into the ancient city of Jaffa, the oldest port in the world.
"Thank you for a very nice day, British patrols and roadblocks notwithstanding."
"You'll have to forgive me," Ari said. "I must leave after dinner for a while."
"What about the curfew?"
"That only applies to Jews," Ari said.
Ari left Kitty and drove from Tel Aviv to the adjoining suburb town of Ramat Gan, the hill garden. It was a contrast to the apartment house city of Tel Aviv in that it was a town of individual homes set in lawns and trees and gardens. The houses were of stucco with red-tiled roofs, and they ranged from cottages to huge villas. Ari parked the car and walked about for more than a half hour to make certain he was not being followed. He came to Montefiore Street 22, a large villa owned by a Dr. Y. Tamir. Dr. Tamir answered the knock, greeted Ari with a warm handshake, and led him downstairs to the basement. The home of Tamir was Haganah headquarters. The cellar held munitions and arms, and a printing press which ground out leaflets in Arabic, warning the Arabs to remain calm and keep the peace. In another section of the basement, a girl spoke in Arabic into a tape recording machine, repeating the warning of the leaflets. The tape would later be transmitted over the secret mobile radio station, Kol Yisrael, the voice of Israel. The manufacturing of hand grenades and the assembly of homemade Sten guns were also among the activities of the underground headquarters. All activity stopped as Dr. Tamir appeared with Ari. The latter was surrounded and congratulated on the Exodus affair. Questions were fired at him from all sides.
"Later, later," Dr. Tamir pleaded. "I must see Avadan," Ari said.
He made his way past the stacked cases of rifles to the door of a secluded office and knocked upon it.
"Yes?"
Ari opened the door and stood before the bald-headed squat farmer who commanded the underground army. Avadan looked up from the papers on his rickety desk and burst into a smile.
"Ari! Shalom!"
He sprang up and threw his arms around Ari's neck, shoved him into a chair, closed the door, and slapped Ari on the back with the force of a pile driver.
"So good to see you, Ari. You did a first-class job on the British. Where are the boys?"
"I sent them home."
"Good. They deserve a few days. Take a few days yourself."
This was an impressive reward from Avadan, who had not taken a day off for himself in a quarter of a century.
Who is the girl you came in with?
An Arab spy. Don't be so nosy.
Is she one of our friends?
No. She isn't a friend. Not even a fellow traveler.
A shame. We could use a good American Christian.
No, she's just a nice woman who looks at Jews as though she were looking into a cage at a zoo. I'm running her up to Jerusalem tomorrow to see Harriet Saltzman about getting her a place in Youth Aliyah.
Something personal, maybe?
Good Lord, no. Now turn your Jewish curiosity somewhere else. The room was stuffy. Avedon pulled out a large blue kerchief and mopped the sweat from his bald pate. That was quite a welcome we got yesterday from the Maccabees. I hear the refinery will be burning for a week. Wrecked production. Avedon shook his head. They did a good job yesterday. But what of the day before yesterday, and what of the day after tomorrow? They are making 3 bad raids to every good one. Every time they resort to brutality or indiscriminate murder, the whole yeshuv suffers. We are the ones who have to answer for Maccabee actions. Tomorrow General Havenhurst and the High Commissioner will be at Yeshuv Central. They'll be pounding their fists on Ben-Gurion's desk, demanding we use the Haganah to apprehend them. I swear I don't know what to do sometimes. So far the British haven't really turned on the Haganah, but I'm afraid if Maccabee terror continues... They've even taken up bank robbery to finance their operations.
British banks, I hope.
Ari lit a cigarette and stood up and paced the tiny office. Perhaps the time has come to stage a few good raids of our own.
No, we just can't risk the Haganah. We are the ones who must defend all the Jews. Illegal immigration, that is the way we will fight them for now. One thing like the Exodus is more important than blowing up 10 Haifa refineries.
But the day must come that we commit ourselves, Avedon. We have an army, or we don't. Avedon took some sheets of paper from his desk drawer and pushed them over toward Ari. Ari thumbed through them. Order of Battle, 6th Airborne Division. Ari looked up.
They have 3 parachute brigades?
Keep reading.
Royal Armored Corps with King's Own Hussars, 53rd Worcestershire, 249th Airborne Park, Dragoon Guards, Royal Lancers, Queen's Royal, East Surrey, Middlesex, Gordon Highlanders, Ulster Rifles, Hertfordshire Regiment. The list of British troops in Palestine ran on and on. Ari threw the papers down on Avedon's desk.
Whom are they fighting? The Russian army?
You see, Ari, every day I go through it with some young hotheads in the Palmach. Why don't we raid? Why don't we come out and fight? Do you think I like it? Ari, they have 20% of the combat strength of the British army here. 100,000 troops. Not counting the Transjordan Arab Legion. Sure, the Maccabees run around shooting up everything, grabbing the limelight, accusing us of hiding.
Avedon slammed his fist on the desk.
By God, I'm trying to put an army together. We haven't even got 10,000 rifles to fight with, and if the Haganah goes, we all go with it. You see, Ari, the Maccabees can keep mobility and hide with a few thousand blowhards. We have got to stall and keep stalling. We can't have a showdown. We can't get Havenhurst angry either. 1 British soldier here for every 5 Jews.
Ari picked up the list of British troops again and studied it in silence.
The British dragnets, cordons, screenings, raids get worse every day. The Arabs are building strength while the British turn their backs.
Ari nodded. Where do I go from here?
I'm not going to give you a command yet. Go on home. Take a few days' rest, then report to Palmach at Ein Or Kibbutz. I want you to assess our strength in every settlement in the Galilee. We want to know what we can expect to hold, and what we're going to lose.
I've never heard you talk like this, Avedon.
Things have never been so bad. The Arabs have refused even to sit at the same conference table and talk with us in London.
Ari walked to the door.
My love to Barak and Sarah, and tell your Dana to behave herself with David Ben-Ami home. I am sending him and the other boys to Ein Or.
I'll be in Jerusalem tomorrow, Ari said. Do you want anything?
Yes. Dig me up 10,000 frontline troops and the arms to outfit them.
Shalom, Avidan.
Shalom, Ari. It is good to have you home.
Ari grew morose as he drove back to Tel Aviv. Long ago, in Cyprus, he had told young David Ben-Ami that many things are tried in the Haganah and Palmach and Aliyah Bet. Some plans work and some fail. A professional should do his work and not become entangled emotionally. Ari Ben-Kanan was a machine. He was an efficient, daring operator. Sometimes he won, sometimes he lost. But once in a while, Ari Ben-Kanan looked at it all with realism, and it nearly crushed him. Exodus, the Haifa refinery, a raid here, a raid there. Men died to smuggle in 50 rifles. Men were hanged for smuggling in 100 frantic survivors. He was a little man fighting a giant. He wished, at that moment, he could have David Ben-Ami's faith in divine intervention. But Ari was a realist. Kitty Fremont waited in the little bar off the lobby for Ari's return. He had been so decent that she wanted to wait up for him and talk some more and have a nightcap or two. She saw him walk into the lobby and go to the desk for his key.
Ari, she called.
His face showed the same deep concentration it had showed that first day she saw him on Cyprus. She waved to him, but he did not even seem to see or to hear her. He looked directly at her, then walked upstairs to his room. Chapter 2 Two buses carrying 50 of the Exodus children drove past the tell of the ruins of Hazor and into the Hula Valley. All during the drive from Haifa through the Galilee, the travelers had been hanging out of the window, cheering and waving and pointing in wonder at the sights of their long-promised land.
Dov, everything is so beautiful, Karen cried.
Dov's grumble, Karen interpreted as meaning that he didn't see so much to make a fuss about. They drove deep into the Hula to Yad El, the home of Ari Ben-Kanan. Here a road branched from the main road and ran up into the hills toward the Lebanese border. The children saw the road sign pointing to Gan Dafna. They nearly exploded with anticipation, with the lone exception of the morose Dov Landau. The buses worked up the winding road, and soon the Hula expanded into full vista, carpeted with green fields of the kibbutzim and moshavim. The rectangular fish ponds made a dozen small lakes around the larger swamplands of Hula Lake. They slowed as they entered the Arab village of Abu Yesha, halfway up the mountains. There was none of the coldness or hostility at Abu Yesha the children had noted in the other Arab villages. They were greeted with friendly waving. Past Abu Yesha, they climbed beyond the 2,000-foot elevation marker and then on to the youth Aliyah village of Gan Dafna, the Garden of Dafna. They stopped before a green lawn measuring 50 by 100 yards in the center of the village. The whole place sat on a large plateau. The center green was surrounded by administration buildings and was the hub of the village, which ran off in all four directions. Flowers and trees and green were everywhere. As the Exodus children debarked, the village orchestra greeted them with a rousing march. In the center of the green stood a life-sized statue of Dafna, the girl after whom the village was named. The figure was cast in bronze with a rifle in her hands, looking down on the Hula, much the same as that day at Hamishmar, when the Arabs had killed her. The village founder, a tiny man with a slight humpback named Dr. Lieberman, stood by the statue of Dafna, smoking a large bowled pipe as he welcomed the new youngsters. He briefly told them that he had left Germany in 1934
and founded Gan Dafna in 1940 on this land which had been generously given to Youth Aliyah by Kamal, the late Mukhtar of Abu Yashar. Dr. Lieberman went to each youngster to speak a few personal words of welcome in a half-dozen languages. As Karen watched him, she had a feeling that she had seen him before. He looked and acted like the professors at Cologne when she was a baby. But it was so long ago, she could not really remember. Each new child was attended by a member of the village.
"Are you Karen Clement?"
"Yes."
"I am Yona, your new roommate,"
said an Egyptian Jewess a bit older than Karen. The two girls shook hands.
"Come, I will show you to our room. You will like it here."
Karen called to Dov that she would see him later, and she walked beside Yona past the administration buildings and the schoolrooms to an area of cottages set in a shrubbed pathway.
"We are lucky," Yona said. "We get the cottages because we are seniors."
Karen stopped a moment before the cottage and looked at it with disbelief, then entered. It was very simple, but Karen thought it the most wonderful room that she had ever seen. A bed, a desk, a wardrobe, and a chair. Her own. Her very own. It was evening before Karen had a free moment. After dinner, the children were to be given a welcoming show at the outdoor theater. Karen met Dov on the green near the statue of Daphne. For the first time in weeks and weeks, she felt like dancing. The air was so crisp and wonderful, and the village was heaven. Karen trembled with happiness. She stood by Dov and pointed to the white clustered houses of Abu Yashar below them in a saddle of the hill. Above them was the Taggart Fort, Fort Esther, on the Lebanese border, and down at the floor of the valley were the fields belonging to the village, adjoining the fields of the Moshav